Had it concentrated its first vigour upon the Byzantine Empire, there could be little doubt that by the 8th century it would have taken Constantinople and come through into Europe as easily as it reached the Pamirs. The caliph, Muawiyah, it's true, besieged the capital for 7 years, 672 to 678, and Suleiman in 717 and 718. But the pressure wasn't sustained, and for 3 or 4 centuries longer, the Byzantine Empire remained the crazy bulwark of Europe. In the newly Christianized or still pagan Avars, Bulgars, Serbs, Slavs, and Saxons, Islam would certainly have found as ready converts as it did in the Turks of Central Asia. And though instead of insisting upon Constantinople it first came round into Europe by the circuitous route of Africa and Spain, it was only in France, at the end of a vast line of communications from Arabia, that it encountered a power sufficiently vigorous to arrest its advance. From the outset, the Bedouin aristocrats of Mecca dominated the new empire. Abu Bekr, the first caliph, was, in an informal shouting way, elected at Medina, and so were Omar I and Othman, the third caliph. But all three were Meccans of good family. They were not men of Medina. And though Abu Bekr and Omar were men of stark simplicity and righteousness, Othman was of a baser quality, a man quite in the vein of those silk robes, to whom conquest wasn't conquest for Allah, but for Arabia, and especially for Mecca in Arabia, and more particularly for himself, and for the Meccans, and for his family, the Umayyads. He was a worthy man, who stood out for his country and his town and his people. He was no early convert, as his two predecessors had been. He'd joined the Prophet for reasons of policy, in fair give and take. With his accession, the caliph ceases to be a strange man of fire and wonder, and becomes an Oriental monarch, like many Oriental monarchs before and since, a fairly good monarch by Eastern standards as yet, but nothing more. The rule and death of Othman brought out the consequences of Muhammad's weaknesses, as clearly as the lives of Abu Bekr and Omar had witnessed to the divine fire in his teaching. Muhammad had been politic at times when Abu Bekr would have been firm, and the new element of aristocratic greediness that came in with Othman was one fruit of those politic moments. And the legacy of that carelessly compiled harem of the Prophet, the family complications and jealousies which had lurked in the background of Muslim affairs during the rule of the first two caliphs, was now coming out into the light of day. Ali, who was the nephew, the adopted son, and the son-in-law of the Prophet, he was the husband of the Prophet's daughter Fatima. He had considered himself the rightful caliph. His claims formed an undertow to the resentment of Medina and of the rival families of Mecca against the advancement of the Umayyads. But Aisha, the favourite wife of the Prophet, had always been jealous of Fatima and hostile to Ali. She supported Othman. The splendid opening of the story of Islam collapses suddenly into this squalid dispute and bickering of heirs and widows. In 656, Othman, an old man of 80, was stoned in the streets of Medina by a mob, chased to his house and murdered. And Ali became at last caliph, only to be murdered in his turn in 661. In one of the battles in the civil war, Aisha, now a gallant, mischievous old lady, distinguished herself by leading a charge mounted on a camel. She was taken prisoner and treated well. While the armies of Islam were advancing triumphantly to the conquest of the world, this sickness of civil war smote at its head. What was the rule of Allah in the world to Aisha when she could score off the detested Fatima, and what heed were the Umayyads and the partisans of Ali likely to take of the unity of mankind when they had a good, hot feud of this sort to entertain them with the caliphate as a prize? The world of Islam was rent in twain by the spites, greeds, and partisan silliness of a handful of men and women in Medina. That quarrel still lives. To this day, one main division of the Muslims, the Shiites, maintain the hereditary right of Ali to be caliph as an article of faith. They prevail in Persia and India. But an equally important section, the Sunnites, with whom it's difficult for a disinterested observer not to agree, deny this peculiar addendum to Muhammad's simple creed. So far as we can gather at this length of time, Ali was an entirely commonplace individual. To watch this schism creeping across the brave beginnings of Islam is like watching a case of softening of the brain. To the copious literature of the subject, we must refer the reader who wishes to learn how Hassan, the son of Ali, was poisoned by his wife, and how Hussein, his brother, was killed. We do but name them here because they still afford a large section of mankind scope for sentimental partisanship and mutual annoyance. They are the two chief Shiite martyrs. Amidst the coming and going of their conflicts, the old Kaaba at Mecca was burnt down, and naturally there began endless disputation whether it should be rebuilt in exactly its ancient form or on a much larger scale. In this and the preceding sections, we've seen once more the inevitable struggle of this newest and latest unifying impulse in the world's affairs against the everyday worldliness of mankind. And we've seen also how from the first the complicated household of Muhammad was like an evil legacy to the new faith. But as this history now degenerates into the normal crimes and intrigues of an Oriental dynasty, the student of history will realize a third fundamental weakness in the world reforms of Muhammad. He was an illiterate Arab, ignorant of history, totally ignorant of all the political experiences of Rome and Greece, and almost as ignorant of the real history of Judea. And he left his followers with no scheme for a stable government embodying and concentrating the general will of the faithful, and no effective form to express the very real spirit of democracy, using the world in its modern sense. That pervades the essential teaching of Islam. His own rule was unlimited autocracy, and autocratic Islam has remained. Politically, Islam was not an advance, but a retrogression from the traditional freedoms and customary laws of the desert. The breach of the Pilgrims' Truce that led to the Battle of Badr is the blackest mark against early Islam. Nominally, Allah is its chief ruler, but practically its master has always been, whatever man was vigorous and unscrupulous enough to snatch and hold the caliphate, and, subject to revolts and assassinations, its final law has been that man's will. For a time after the death of Ali, the Umayyad family was in the ascendant, and for nearly a century they gave rulers to Islam. The Arab historians are so occupied with the dynastic squabbles and crimes of the time that it's difficult to trace the external history of the period. We find Muslim shipping upon the seas, defeating the Byzantine fleet in a great sea fight off the coast of Lycia in AD 655. But how the Muslims acquired this victorious fleet thus early, we don't clearly know. It was probably chiefly Egyptian. For some years, Islam certainly controlled the eastern Mediterranean, and in 662 and again in 672, during the reign of Muawiyah, 662 to 680, the first great Umayyad caliph made two sea attacks upon Constantinople. They had to be sea attacks because Islam, so long as it was under Arab rule, never surmounted the barrier of the Taurus Mountains. During the same period, the Muslims were also pressing their conquest further and further into Central Asia. While Islam was already decaying at its center, it was yet making great hosts of new adherents and awakening a new spirit among the hitherto divided and aimless Turkish peoples. Medina was no longer a possible center for its vast enterprises in Asia, Africa, and the Mediterranean, and so Damascus became the usual capital of the Umayyad caliphs.